Hello and welcome to Pythagorean Astronomy. I'm Chris North, and what you're about to listen to was originally broadcast as part of Pythagoras' Trousers, a science and engineering show on Radio Cardiff. You can find a full show and listen to past episodes at pythagorastrousers.co.uk. But for now, here's this month's astronomy. Early this month, we hosted, along with the National Museum of Wales, a public talk about the Rosetta mission, the fascinating spacecraft which is orbiting the fascinating spacecraft which is orbiting Comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko, and also has a lander, of course, on its surface. The talk was given by Professor Mark McCorkran, who's the senior science advisor in the European Space Agency's Directorate of Science and Robotic Exploration. Quite a long title, you must admit, so I thought I'd begin by asking Mark what that meant.
We're a big organisation, 10 directorates in ESA, and each one of those directorates is responsible for a certain area. So we have things like launches, telecommunications, human spaceflight, technology, and the directorate I work in is called Science and Robotic Exploration. And within that, I'm responsible for the communications and outreach of our missions, the space science missions. So the things we'll talk about perhaps in this podcast here, missions from Planck, Herschel, Mars Express, and so on, and of course Rosetta.
And so for many of these, I was looking on the website earlier, so I counted 14 ongoing missions, and that's either missions ongoing or just finished and just finalising sort of the analysis of the data, and 7 to come, and about 8 in the past, 8 that have finished and are completely finished. That's at least what's on the website. There may be more, I suppose. And that made me think that actually, although ESA's been around for a long time, people may not have heard about it until recently, but in terms of missions, compared with American cousins, it's quite young in terms of number of missions in this field. So how has ESA changed in the last 20 years, I suppose, in that sense of kind of growing up to new missions or to do more missions?
Well, we've been, you know, flying missions for a long time. The agency just had its 50th birthday, although that wasn't really ESA. It was the component parts of ESA. There used to be two organisations, one called ELDO, European Launcher Development Organisation, that led on to Ariane, and then the European Scientific Research Organisation, ESRO. So ESA came together as an organisation a bit later than that, but we were already doing space science missions there. So I'd have to go back and check the numbers that you have there, but it's certainly true that we got a somewhat later start, and part of the motivation was to have a European capability for putting space science missions together. But it was probably in the 2000s, in the decade at the beginning of this millennium, where ESA came fully up to speed in terms of lots of missions exploring the solar system, astrophysics missions spanning the electromagnetic spectrum. And indeed, we actually had our peak of operating missions a couple of years ago. And we're now at a couple below that. But as you said, there's lots of missions in the planning. Things have been selected. And we have a program which is already scoped out for some of the missions out into the mid-2030s already, which is a little bit scary, but those are kind of the big cornerstones. And there's still room for medium-class missions, as we call them, to come in. So there's a lot to come. You're right, we don't have as long a history, but lots of things operating today and lots more to come in the near future.
And you say you got it planned out till the 2030s. I mean, 2030 is only 15 years ago, which in space mission terms isn't actually that long. These billion euro missions take a lot of planning. I have involvement with both Planck and Herschel, you mentioned earlier, and I know they've been going for 2 decades, right? And they've just sort of finished their scientific operations a couple of years ago. So they do take a long time, and that must have its own challenges of trying to plan ahead for, I mean, even things like the economy in 15 years.
Yeah. Well, I think that's true. I mean, part of the reason that they take so long is very often when you're trying to push the limits of science, you're actually having to develop whole new technologies. So we tend to have a fairly long phase at the beginning. There's an argumentative phase where people try and say, my science is better or more interesting than yours, pick me now. So there's that whole classical propose, review, select. But even after that, there's quite a lot of technology development that might be needed to progress from things which might be working in the lab very well, but actually make them ready for space with the reliability and all of the issues associated with launches and cosmic rays and so on. And alongside with that, of course, is then when you start building the hardware, testing the heck out of it. Because if you don't actually test it and you launch it, you generally have no way of fixing it. So that lead time is not that people are sitting around twiddling their thumbs, quite the opposite. There's a huge amount of work that then culminates in the launch and the science mission itself. For me, one thing I've been working on for a long time now is the James Webb Space Telescope, which is, easily put, the successor to the Hubble Space Telescope. And that's due for launch in 2018. I first got involved in 1998, so that will be 20 years. And you're right, it's hard maintaining the people, not the momentum, I think that's always there, but keeping people, because quite often you use the most senior people to get a project going and they retire and you bring in new people. And there is a whole sociological problem attached with it, not just the scientific problem.
The James Webb and the Hubble is something that people think of them as NASA missions. They're probably two of the big examples that at least I can think of missions that people think of as being NASA missions, but in fact have ESA involvement. And how does ESA, I guess, how do you deal with it? Do you mind? I mean, do you have to realize you don't mind that, or how does that work?
Well, there are a whole bunch of missions where NASA's in the lead, and actually there's a lot of missions where we're in the lead, and NASA's a small minor partner. You mentioned Herschel and Planck. Both of them actually have rather small minority NASA contributions. In fact, that's probably the way we like it these days, because if you get to 50-50 missions where there's equal partnerships, they're much harder to manage. Nobody has overall responsibility, so to speak. And so our motivation moving forward now is very much to have us in the lead of a fraction, NASA or other partners. We work with the Japanese Space Agency, we work with the Russians, to have them in the lead so that there's a clearly defined center. I don't mind that at all. In fact, we have this policy in space science called Open Skies that anybody can apply to use a mission as a scientist. So even somebody from Australia can apply into James Webb Space Telescope, even if they're not involved, and all the data become public later on as well. So I think that that actually benefits everybody, that we collaborate together. There's a lovely neologism called coopetition, though, which is cooperation and competition. So it's clear that we also do things to try and get ahead of each other and to be the first to do something. And there have been in the past missions where we've actually, I wouldn't say duplicated exactly, but gone into the same field in a fairly short period relative to each other. So Planck is a classic example where there was the WMAP mission and then later Planck, two missions going to Mercury, MESSENGER, BepiColombo. And there are things now which we're in the lead of, things like Euclid, which is a dark energy, dark matter mission, dark universe, and NASA is planning its WFIRST mission, which would be launched afterwards. Right. So at some points, you would like to have a little bit more common planning, but it usually works out.
Yeah, and of course, you've got the mission, this is on the 2030 kind of timescale, but the mission is to Jupiter, so JUICE, as it's currently called. I guess it may get a different name by the time it launches. And NASA are now talking about having a Europa mission as well, so one of Jupiter's moons. So again, there's that kind of tandem approach.
Yeah, I mean, I think perhaps this would be slightly controversial. It's not that one I don't quite understand, to be honest. I think it's worth pointing out that NASA actually didn't plan to do Europa Clipper. They were mandated by Congress to do Europa Clipper, or at least have been given money to do the next study, because NASA's part of JUICE. They already have instrumentation on. They're investing a significant amount of money. We're going to Europa. We're going to fly past it. We're not going to go into orbit around Europa, because the radiation dose there, relative, it's all to do with where the magnetosphere of Jupiter is. Europa's highly dangerous environment for electronics. So we're actually going to end up in orbit around Ganymede, whereas you might argue that, you know, Europa has an ocean as Ganymede under the thick ice, but Europa's ocean probably is in contact with rock at the bottom, whereas Ganymede's is thought not to be. So, yeah, that's one where I actually would have been happier, to be frank, where if NASA had said, well, let's go to Enceladus, because the moon of Saturn, that would be completely complementary, and that would be much more natural for us to join in on as well. We may yet join in on Europa Clipper, depending on how things work out.
Yeah. And this is where the economies come in, I suppose, because originally when a Jupiter mission was in its initial plans, NASA were going to be involved in that mission to a much greater level, and in fact go to Europa, I believe. So this is, I guess, the NASA, as with all space agencies or all public agencies, has had its own challenges with budgets over the last decade, where everything's gone a bit haywire. And that must play into what happens. And government's changing, with NASA, certainly.
Yeah, I think actually you can make a sort of a virtue out of a necessity. We have longer planning timescales. We have a bit more stability in our program as well, because we have now more than 20 member states. It doesn't twist and turn on one government changing. We have this whole continuity, and that tends to allow us to plan out on a somewhat longer time scale with that stability. It was true that with both the mission that used to be called EJSM, Europa Jupiter System mission, two satellites going, one to study Europa specifically, the other one to study the system of all the moons in Jupiter. We also had other missions like the joint Mars mission with NASA, gravitational waves, X-rays. One of the issues there is the alignment of the timescales in which you make decisions. And of course, in the US system, they have the famous decadal reviews where they will pick the big winner, if you like, the one mission to do. And we don't influence that process. So we might plan to go and do something with them or with any other partner, but if their cycle works out differently. So at the moment, that is one of the reasons, however, why we've kind of tried to move away from 50-50 missions, where if you have a partnership where you really fundamentally rely on the other side, whichever partner, then that jeopardizes your planning schedule. Whereas if they're in at 10 or 15% or less, you can pretty much go it on your own if they don't pitch in later, and vice versa.
Yeah. Now, to speak of a mission that's almost solely ESA, is Rosetta, of course, which is kind of the mission of the moment. It's been one of the most exciting missions I've witnessed, and it's not had, I mean, its launch was 10 years ago, it's not had a exciting landing on Mars, which can be very fiery and exciting and you can have a lot of press attention, but the story of Rosetta has been played up so well in the press. And the press may be different, maybe they're different to how they were 10 years ago, but the press have really latched on to Rosetta. And is that something that you and your team in ESA Communications have really, was that much more of an effort on you, or do you think it is the press changing that's helped?
I think both going together. I mean, one thing that's certainly very different in the last 10 years is social media, whether that's, you know, regular press and television on top of that, and they participate in social media, so you can build a buzz very quickly. But we did. We knew very well that Rosetta was going to be very significant for ESA, for Europe, for space, for science, and even beyond that, for this whole issue of inspiration. You know, it's a mission which is unique in many ways, with a long journey, a long gestation period until launch, as we talked about before, but then the 10-year journey of playing cosmic billiards around the solar system to actually get there, the jeopardy of having to put it into hibernation in 2011, and then waking it up. And one of the things that we did, made a very conscious choice about at the beginning of 2014, actually much to the objections of the engineers involved, was setting up a huge media event around coming out of hibernation on January the 20th, 2014. The engineers were rather nervous about this. It had never been done before for this length of time. They would have much rather that what we did was actually wake it up, or rather wait to hear from it, that it woken up, and then put a press release out the next morning. And we said, no, do it live. Do it in real time, because if it fails, you'll still have to explain that tomorrow, and at least you've been transparent, you've done it in real time. But if it succeeds, it will build the story for the rest of the year. And it did. That was very important, because it allowed, you know, people like documentary makers to come in and build a story over the arc until November, when Philae landed on the comet. And it allowed us to start partnering with many people, which snowballed our media efforts and our outreach efforts. It gave the general media something to keep jumping in on. They had Wake Up in January, they had Rendezvous in August, they had preparations for landing. And even this year, a year later, we had the Wake Up of Philae again in June. So this is the mission that keeps on giving. Much of it planned, but some of it definitely not. I mean, the jeopardy of Philae, landing, bouncing, hiding away in a corner and its battery dying. I mean, the social media outpouring on Twitter, I mean, were people around the world actually crying when this, frankly, box of electronics, his battery ran out. And we played quite a role there, I think. We anthropomorphized the spacecraft, you know, and some people found that too cute, that we gave them faces and played cartoons. But we did serious science for that audience. We did science fiction. We did regular blogging. We put images out. And we did the cartoons. No one product works for everybody. And I think that those things all fed off each other. And the media played with those things and used them in different ways. But fundamentally, it was all about the mission. The mission has been this astonishing journey of exploration, of endeavor, of to take the name from our science fiction film, of ambition, of doing something that's really hard to do, and having people watch you wanting it to work out. So I think we got much more coverage than we could ever have dreamed of. But it was definitely, the pump was primed, and we put a lot of effort into putting the material out there.
I mean, comparing that with a NASA mission, New Horizons past Pluto a couple of months ago, also very exciting. Our first close-up glimpses of a new world and a very fleeting glimpse. And there was equally press attention around that. And I think in some senses, having Rosetta and Philae landing last year and then New Horizons this year, people are waking up to space science. In the same way that it's maybe not as extreme, but does it feel in that sense like a smaller version of kind of the space race in the Apollo era in that sense, do you think?
Lots of people have said this. You know, I'm old enough that I don't believe the next thing I'm about to say. But a lot of people have come up, younger people have said this for them has been their Apollo moment, the landing on the comet at the end of last year. Now, you know, anybody who's old enough to remember Apollo will think it was a vastly bigger endeavor with, you know, just the resources of an entire country turned to it. It also has the human element. But I can't deny the younger people saying that because they didn't live through Apollo. I mean, that excitement was real. It was on the TV. They had access to it perhaps in a somewhat less mediated way than it had been in the past. New Horizons coming along immediately afterwards certainly, you know, is keeping that going. You said earlier on it's mostly a European mission. There is a NASA involvement in Rosetta, and indeed one of the instruments on Rosetta, the PI for that, is actually Alan Stern is the PI for New Horizons.
Right.
So he and his team, you know, they had this huge double whammy in the space of less than a year. So for them, the excitement was enormous. But yeah, it's an interesting thing. People have been talking about space 2.0. You know, why is it that we're getting interested in space again? It's really not the man side particularly. Mm. It really is the robots doing this amazing stuff.
So human space flight, I mean, with the advent of the shuttle, I grew up in the shuttle era. So when I grew up, the space shuttle was just how you got to space. I grew up and the space shuttle was there. It was launching. It was post-Challenger, so that first crisis already gone. And it was just routine. And for me as a young kid, as a teenager, that was very, very exciting to have just routine space travel. That made Star Trek feel more real, you know, because we all were doing that kind of, we're going to space at least. But recently, human spaceflight has become less of that. It does feel like it's become more routine. The media have kind of turned off the big events of all the launches and, you know, the fact that there are six people in space and every 6 months another three go up and all this kind of stuff has kind of died away, and it does feel like the human story of the unmanned space flight, the robotic space exploration that's really, really come to the fore.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things we all have to keep in mind is that in 1969, when first men went to the moon, if you make a scale model of the Earth and you shrink the Earth down by a factor of 100 million... It more or less fits between your fingers. If you put your fingertips together and you make a ball, that's the size of the Earth when shrunk down by that much. To the same scale, the moon is 4 meters away, which is, you know, quite a long way. But since 1972, we've been confined to within 3 or 4 millimeters of the surface of that globe. So going to the moon was an enormous thing. And going to space in any sense as a human being is highly challenging. And as you say, the people going around in the ISS, we shouldn't forget about them. But it doesn't challenge people's sense of exploration and a sense of new endeavour the same way that Apollo did in 69 to 72, and the way that the robots are doing now. They're doing astonishing things, whether that's crashing through the atmosphere of Mars, landing on the Curiosity sky crane, the most bonkers piece of technology you've ever seen. And it worked, you know, and trying to put a comet, put a lander on the surface of a comet, or wait 10 years as you fly past this icy body called Pluto, way out the edge of the solar system. So I think it has helped that social media has been there, because people can immediately interact and they're not sort of being fed dry facts. The anthropomorphization, well, it worked for us on Rosetta and Philae. It won't work for everything, of course. But people have really taken ownership of this again. And a lot of people ask me, well, when will you be able to judge whether it's changed anything? What is it as a marker that says you've had an impact? To which I reply, partly to cheat, is ask me in 20 years' time. Because it's kids like you from the shuttle, people like me from Apollo, you know, we went into this business later on as a consequence. It's not 1 year later that you can measure that. So then maybe there will be in 20 years' time the children of Rosetta and of New Horizons who will be building amazing technologies and, frankly, helping solve problems on the planet Earth, which is something I feel deeply passionate about. People ask me, why do you spend your life in space when we've got problems on the Earth? Well, it's through the inspiration of these missions that if we can bring kids into STEM subjects, we have a hope, actually. Not all of them could be space scientists or astronomers, but maybe they'll go off and work out how to solve energy crisis or water problems. So I think they have that value as well, beyond what they do in and of themselves.
Astronomy has that wonderful role in that astronomy, as you say, promotes or inspires people to go into all sorts of fields of science and engineering, technology and everything, as we're seeing with Apollo and perhaps, as you say, may be seen in the future. But one of the things that astronomy has that many other fields of science don't have to such a degree is the pictures. I mean, the pictures we get back, certainly now, and this may be something that's changed in 20 years, where newspapers can print amazing pictures now. The pictures we get back from Rosetta, from New Horizons, they're absolutely astonishing. And the cameras aren't necessarily that high-tech compared with what's in my mobile phone here. But the pictures are stunning, and that's something that I think has helped people push forward. And you must have a challenge to persuade the science teams who really want to keep their data, their images to themselves, because they want to be able to analyse them first, with also saying you've got to show people your pictures.
I'll come back to that one, but the, you know, even recently, just talking to a colleague who visited at the weekend, we were involved in 1994, so 20 years before Rosetta arrived at Comet 67P, we're involved in Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9, which fragmented as it went past Jupiter and then came back around the next time and was seen, and it was calculated it was going to crash into Jupiter. And there were big observing campaigns set up all around the world. And we had a telescope. I was working in Germany then. We had a telescope in southern Spain at Calor Alto, which had an infrared camera on it. And because of our physical location, we were the first to see the impacts, and the impacts were much bigger than anybody had anticipated. But it's quite remarkable, only 20 years ago, that the way we got the pictures to the press is they were sent by computer connection, by internet, from southern Spain to Germany. We then actually had to physically print them out on hard copy and then drive them to Frankfurt to Associated Press, where they were then scanned in and put on the wire. I mean, so that immediacy of being able to get images out like that. And as you say, how do I tension that against the fact that scientists have worked for decades in order to build the instruments, to do the science which they propose to get the mission selected in the first place? Should they give that all away just because the public want to see it on the day when we arrive at the comet? And I think it's a very delicate balance. Of course, the taxpayer pays for these missions. And for reasons that alone, but also for reasons of engagement and inspiration and just sort of building an interest in space, we need to put the images out as quickly as possible, certainly at the big events. Should we put all of them out? You know, there's a measure there. What about, you know, 1%, for example? 1% of thousands is enough, certainly, to engage. And that's something we struggle with a little bit, particularly on Rosetta, but on other missions as well. But it's exposed an issue there for us, I think. And we're looking at the whole policy of image releases in terms of proprietary periods, how long the scientists get to hold on to the data before releasing them. But one of the ironies in this is that if you think about Hubble, for example, people say, all the images from Hubble, I can see those all the time. Well, they're typically a year old already. Yes. And the point is, it doesn't really matter, because Andromeda Galaxy, if I take a wonderful picture of it and give it to you a year later, it hasn't changed much in that year. Events which happen in real time, exploration events, we got very used in the 1970s and 80s, the flybys of the planet, the first landings on Mars and so on, to getting images out immediately, partly because they were just TV, effectively. They weren't digitized images which were then stored and downloaded. They had to be some kind of real-time signal to get back to Earth. So now, with these digital imaging devices where the images get stored, there's a lag partly because of the mechanics. We can't always just turn the antenna back at the Earth. But indeed, it's an area where we've struggled a little bit on Rosetta. I think we've done pretty well in the end. We've got a lot of pictures out, certainly out of our navigation cameras. But the scientific cameras and the other instruments as well, that has been a bit of a bone of contention. And we never wanted to insist that people gave all their data away, not at all. That wouldn't be in anybody's benefit, but perhaps a little bit more, And it was really between the events, because on the day of the events, we pretty much did get out the best stuff possible from the instruments. But in between, there was a little bit of a geeky expectation that people were going to be able to play with data and download it and do what they wanted with it. And that's been true on some of the Mars missions. It's now true on Cassini around Saturn. But no, it wasn't true at the beginning. And one of the arguments is that with Mars, we've been there a bunch of times. So we kind of know what the surface looks like. And giving away the images in a compressed form, but not the other data from the other instruments, well, that's kind of okay. Whereas nobody's ever done this at a comet before. So there was that tension as well. As I might, every picture might contain the scientific discovery I've been working my whole career for. So yeah, it's been a, we've lost a lot of sleep over it, and there's certainly still tension there, but it's been a good object lesson. We're looking at new ways of doing it for the future for other missions.
Well, speaking of the future, we should finish off by saying what should we look forward to in the next year from ESA? What's coming up that will grab everyone's attention?
Well, an obvious one in a way, because it's a bit more along the lines of exploration, is the first ExoMars mission. We collaborate with the Russian Space Agency on two missions, one which is going to launch at the beginning of next year. And that's going to be an orbiter, which is going to fly around Mars, partly to actually act as a data relay for future missions, but it's also going to be measuring the gases in the atmosphere, and particularly looking for very rare gases like methane, which might be traces of extant life under the surface. It could also be traces of geology, but if we know there's methane in Mars's atmosphere, very small amounts, but we need to measure it in much more detail, find out where it's coming from, how it changes with the seasons. We're also going to put a lander onto the surface from that mission. It's a pretty, it's a technology demonstrator lander. It's going to go down, thud onto the surface. It'll be the first time Europe has hopefully successfully landed. Everybody knows Beagle 2 made it to the surface, didn't deploy fully. Our lander in 2016 is really to just test the initial technologies, and it's only battery powered. It'll run out after 3 days. But this is all the preface to 2018, when we launch the next mission, which will have a big rover driving around, drilling under the surface, looking for perhaps not existing life, but signs of former life. But we have other things we're doing in the meantime. In fact, the launch before ExoMars is a very, very strange mission called LISA Pathfinder. And Pathfinder is a technology mission trying to prove the extraordinary level of precise technology you need to potentially discover and measure gravitational waves in space. That's a mission way out in the future, but we're going to test the technology today. And essentially, it's a very odd mission. We hope to be able to explain this to people. What you need to be able to prove is that if you have two objects flying through space, that you can fly them totally undisturbed by any external influence, like the solar wind, for example, blowing things around. You say, well, it's not very strong, it won't blow them around. Well, at the level of precision we need to be able to detect gravitational waves, that's a huge issue. So what we're going to do is fly two gold cubes, about 2 inches square, and they're going to be about 25 centimeters apart, and they're going to be flying next to each other, but completely uncoupled from the spacecraft. They're not going to touch the spacecraft at all. They're just going to fly along through space, falling freely through gravity. And the whole game of the spacecraft is to shield them from the outside influence. So if the spacecraft feels the solar wind pushing it towards the cube, it will actually sense that it's moving towards the cube and then fire a little thruster on the other side to move it away again. So the whole game of the satellite is to avoid ever touching the cube. It's like one of those things in the old fairground where you would get your metal ring and try to avoid touching the wire. And the level of precision we've got to achieve with that is just unbelievable. I was thinking about this morning, one way of trying to phrase that. Imagine if you were standing on the Shard in London and you were trying to measure your distance to the Empire State Building. Okay. If take that to scale with what LISA Pathfinder is doing. LISA Pathfinder could detect if you took a human hair and sliced it lengthways 4 times into quarters and you pasted that on the side of the Empire State Building, LISA Pathfinder would be able to sense that extra distance, or that shortening of the distance, at the level of precision it's doing it inside the spacecraft. Wow. So it's a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction. It's a millionth of a millionth of a meter that we can sense to. And that technology is needed, because in the future, if we want to detect gravitational waves, we need the same precision. But then those two cubes, instead of being 25 centimeters apart, will have to be a million kilometers apart, linked by laser beams. So we have that. That's being launched this year, and we have a mission to Mercury called BepiColombo in 2017. We have a mission to go close to the sun, solar orbiter, in 2018. Then we have James Webb and JUICE and all of these things coming. So there's an enormous amount before the end of the decade.
Okay, so we'll keep our eyes peeled on the ESA website, I guess. Is
And hopefully on the front pages of newspapers and on your TV screens as well.
Certainly look forward to it. Mark McCorkran, thanks very much.
Thank you, Chris.
Certainly lots to look forward to in the coming years, but let's turn now to what's coming up in the next month in the skies directly above us. So Hugh Lang, welcome back.
Hello, Chris.
Start in the evening after the sunset, and we've got Saturn just slowly disappearing.
Yes, I'm afraid there is only one planet out that people can easily spot, and it's the ringed wonder, Saturn. It's still reasonably well placed in the early evening sky, but by mid-evening to late evening, it's so far into the murk as you won't be able to make anything out. So
starting to head beside the sun.
That's right.
The outermost planets, Uranus and Neptune, are up and are observable if you've got binoculars or a telescope.
That's right. Of course, you're going to have a star map to find them, both Uranus and Neptune. Neptune is just at opposition on the first of the month, so that'll be up all night. Unfortunately, it's quite a faint object, so you certainly will need a binoculars or a telescope to locate. Uranus, which is a bit brighter, it's just about naked eye brightness from a fairly darkish site. You wouldn't see it from Cardiff. These planets look quite stellar in appearance unless you have a reasonable sized telescope. But the
so
way you can discern
them, they look like points of light still.
That's right, yeah. Basically. But of course, you can discern them because they do have a distinctive colour in that Uranus and Neptune look greeny bluish through a pair of binoculars. So they do stand out amongst the stars.
And of course, if you want to know how to find them, then a good place to start is astronomical societies or observing groups. So if you're in the Cardiff area, of course, there's Cardiff Astronomical Society.
That's right. The society will restart on Thursday, September the 3rd, and it meets in the university. So everybody who's interested in coming along, they're welcome to. They just have to actually look at the Cardiff website. But of course, we also hold observing sessions, and there are a number coming up in September. So if you do just want to look at the stars, you can always come down to Dufferin Gardens. Again, the information is on the website. All they have to do is just look it up and come along.
Excellent. And of course, the reason most observing groups are starting around this time of year, we're heading towards the autumn equinox. Skies are getting darker.
That's right, and they get darker a lot quicker now. Apart from the night being longer, of course, it gets darker earlier, so it's a lot more convenient for the younger members of or prospective members of society or people who want to look at the stars to see them.
Yeah, and we're as the sun moves south in the sky, which makes our northern nights longer, we do quite rapidly lose those summer constellations.
That's so. Right, we do. But the summer triangle will suddenly disappear, very rapidly disappear, which are the three bright stars, of course. And, of course, Biotis with the bright star Arcturus will also be sinking into the west quite rapidly as well. So all the summer indicators will have disappeared. And of course, will be replaced by objects like Orion, which everybody loves and knows.
Yeah, so we'll transition into sort of the winter constellations of the next month or so.
That's right.
Coming up at the end of the month, we've got a treat in the total eclipse of the moon on the night of the 27th going into 28th of September. It's a late one, though.
It's a long total eclipse, but you have to be a night owl to go and watch the whole event. It's going to be from midnight onwards till the early hours of the early morning.
The total phase when the moon looks red will be from just after 3 a.m. until about 4:30.
That's correct. Yes, so, it is quite late. But of course, if you're up at that late, of course you'll see the bright planets rising just before sunlight, and you'll be able to find Mars, Venus, and Jupiter. Venus being the brightest for the whole year. In actual fact, that would be a sight to see.
Excellent. So a red moon and the bright planets.
That's right.
So if you're up early, go and have a look. Hugh, thanks very much.
Thanks, Chris.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North. It was originally broadcast on Radio Cardiff as part of Pythagoras' Trousers.